You are listening to the Freight Buyers Club, a home for those interested in international trade, shipping, procurement, logistics, and air freight. In fact, all things supply chain in the Americas, Asia, and beyond. This podcast is brought to you by your host, Mike King, and produced in partnership with Demerco Express Group, a global 3PL that specializes in managing logistics to, from, and within the Asia-Pacific region.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Freight Buyers Club, which, as you've just heard, is produced with the support of Demerco Express Group. I'm Mike King, and please do follow, like, review, and subscribe to this podcast on your platform of choice, including YouTube. It really will help us keep providing this content for you, and we'd much appreciate it. You'll also find loads of additional shorts and news insights on both YouTube and at www.thefreightbuyersclub.com. Well, we're getting close to those US presidential elections, aren't we? I think it's one of the most globally important elections in recent history, certainly in terms of how it will impact global trade rules, geopolitics, and the shipping costs that US importers and exporters will face over the next presidential term. So today we're looking at the key protagonists and their respective policies, or at least our best guess of what they might be. Now, to discuss what we can expect from each candidate and how trade policy affects consumer tech companies, later on, Ed Briswar, VP of International Trade at the Consumer Technology Association, will be joining us. Ed has held a string of high-profile trade roles and is the former director for APEC Affairs at the Office of the United States Trade Representative, so absolutely perfectly qualified to help us look at some of these issues. But first up, I'm delighted to welcome Stephen Olson. Over the course of his more than 30-year international career, Stephen has lived and worked in Asia, the Middle East, and the United States, holding senior executive positions in the private sector, government, research institutions, and academia. He began his career in Washington, D.C. as a trade negotiator and is currently a visiting fellow at the Institute of Southeast Asian Studies, Yusof Ishak Institute. He's also a member of the World Economic Forum's Global Futures Council on Trade and co-leads a joint workstream with the WEF Global Futures Council on Geopolitics. Stephen, welcome to the Freight Buyers Club.
Well, thanks very much, Michael. A real pleasure to be with you.
Stephen, how do you see the Harris and Trump election in terms of what they're saying on trade policy and perhaps also on logistics or transport infrastructure support or investment? Do we have clear blue water between them?
Sure. Well, look, I think it's safe to say that neither of the candidates are what we would call ardent proponents of free trade. Clearly, Trump has articulated what would be the most protectionist U.S. trade policy in at least 100 years, probably beyond that. The approach Harris is taking is a bit more nuanced, but I would point out all indications are that she would continue maintaining the Trump-era tariffs, just as the Biden administration did. And she's also expressed a willingness to use tariffs that are strategic and targeted to support U.S. workers. To me, if I was some of the United States trading partners, I'd be concerned about that type of language. In terms specifically of logistics and transport, I have to say, just to be completely honest, I haven't seen any evidence that former President Trump has ever thought about logistics, so I don't think he's got a clearly articulated vision for what he wants to do there. In fairness, it's not an issue that Harris talks a lot about either. However, I would say that she's been very clear on the need to enhance competitiveness of U.S. workers, and if she is serious about that, then she's got to get into the transport, logistics, and infrastructure questions as well.
Have we seen any clear indications from Trump or Harris that when it comes to specific sectors, that they favor certain industries on trade policy?
Well, in terms of Harris, I think her proclivity is going to be towards really trying to build out industries that are associated with green technologies or the green transition. Her commitment to climate change is well documented. I think we're going to see that throughout her economic policies and throughout her trade policies as well. Trump, on the other hand, seems to be more reactive. Where is a hot button issue? Where is a particular political payoff for him in terms of which industries to select? But I think Harris clearly is going to be focused on green technologies and the green transition.
as you say, that there has been some black holes in terms of what we know about policies that might be implemented. But one big issue that has come up from both camps, actually, is tariffs. Trump has shown rather a lot more policy leg on this than Harris, if I may put it like that. Let me throw in an example here from Trump and followed by a reply from Harris.
To me, tariffs are a very beautiful word. It's a word that's going to make our country rich again. Without tariffs, we have a busted country. We owe $35 trillion.
You don't just throw around the idea of just tariffs across the board. And that's part of the problem with Donald Trump. He's just not very serious about how he thinks about some of these issues.
Obviously, Trump has said a lot about tariffs. Apart from that, they are, for him, the solution to America's economic ills, more or less. There's been a lot less detail from Harris, except to say she takes that very different view we heard there. And it's worth pointing out the Biden administration hasn't really rescinded a lot of the previous Trump tariffs that were implemented in his first administration, and it added a fair few of its own. So what does all this mean? Stephen, is Harris all about continuity, as far as we can tell? And is Trump all about ramping up tariff wars? Is it that simple?
Well, I'd weave a little bit of nuance into that, Michael. Keep in mind with Trump, Trump considers himself to be the consummate negotiator, right? It's all about the art of the deal. Now, he's talked about these astronomical tariffs. It's possible that in his mind, to the extent he's thought this through and has a clearly articulated vision, at least within his own mind, it's possible that these could be used for negotiating leverage. So in other words, the idea would be to either implement or to threaten to implement these astronomical tariffs and then use that as leverage to negotiate quasi-mercantilist trade agreements. We know that Trump views a trade surplus or a trade deficit like a sports scorecard to indicate who's quote unquote winning or losing in the game of international trade. And so he might use this as leverage to sort of force negotiation into, as I said, a mercantilist trade deal. And I think we've got a real world example of it, the Phase 1 agreement that was negotiated during his first term, which committed China to a number of specified purchases of U.S. products, which in fact never happened. So clearly, Trump is articulating what I think under normal circumstances we would refer to as a shocking level of tariff increases. Let's see what happens. I think there's at least a possibility that these will be used as negotiating leverage for trade deals. Harris, for her part, this is not a woman who's ever really indicated strong support for traditional free trade policies. She was one of only 10 U.S. senators to have voted against the revised NAFTA agreement, the USMCA. And she indicated at that time that if she had been a member of Congress during when the CPT, first the TPP, which subsequently became the TPP, was negotiated, she would have voted against that as well. So I think certainly I don't see her removing any of the Trump-era tariffs that the Biden administration had maintained. And I don't think there's any question that she won't hesitate to use additional tariffs when or if she feels that's necessary to support U.S. workers.
Yeah, I'll come back to that point you make there about this cross-party almost, or certain at least these two leaders are very much in that protectionist historical trend that we've always had in the U.S., which is very interesting. I'm very interested in what that means for the U.S.'s ability to project its own power, in a sense, and what that means for its allies. Come back to that in a moment. But the continuation of that Trump interview that I played a clip from earlier, he does actually go on to say he'll increase tariffs on EVs produced by Chinese companies in Mexico. He starts at 200%, then he goes up to 500%. And he said, I'll do anything to protect U.S. car companies. So this rhetoric, we should separate that out from what might happen. This is part of the negotiation. It's part of the deal. It's part of this neo-mercantilism that we've seen arise of, the idea that this is all a zero-sum game. And if I win, you lose. And that's the relationship with all partners, not just China, but also the EU even.
Well, look, I think it certainly could be a negotiating ploy, but I won't make any claims to being privy to the inner thoughts of former President Trump. So we'll have to see. The other comment, though, I'd make that bears on this question is also keep in mind that Trump reflexively has to be the most protectionist guy in the room. Okay. So wherever else the political mainstream is, he's going to outdo them. And so as the political center has shifted in the United States, at least in terms of trade policy, where Biden maintained some strongly protectionist policies, Trump has to outdo his opponents in the Democratic Party. So you referenced the 200% tariffs on China EVs. Biden said 100%. Trump said 200%. You know, it makes you wonder if Biden had said 200%, would Trump say 400%? So there's this inclination that he's always going to up the ante and nobody is going to out protectionism Trump. So there's an element of that in the mix as well.
He's also talked about a universal import tariff of 10%. We're going to see a lot of retaliation if that happens. It'll hurt U.S. industry and the U.S. economy, won't it?
It will. And I think this is the real danger. If anything even approaching the tariffs that he sort of floated actually do come to pass, I don't think there's any question that the major trading partners of the United States are going to have to retaliate. I don't see any way, practically speaking, that they can just absorb this and say, okay, fine, we'll live with it. I think there's got to be a response. I think certainly the EU would respond forcefully. I think certainly China would respond forcefully. Now, what we know from the previous Trump administration is that just leads us down the path of tit for tat retaliation, because if the Europeans or the Chinese retaliate, Trump will not sit tight. Trump will further ratchet things up, presumably forcing a response on the other side. So there's a real danger here that we could be heading for a spiraling trade war along the lines of what we saw in the aftermath of the Smoot-Hawley tariffs during the 1930s. I hope I'm wrong, but that's at least a possibility.
Right, okay. Worst case scenario is almost there. Who's, in your views, driving policy within the Trump camp? Is it, as some people have said, Robert Lighthizer, who, this, for those who don't know, he was the de facto trade chief during Trump's first term. He's also put out a book called No Trade is Free Trade, in which he outlines a pretty much an ideological case that there are economic, geopolitical, and moral reasons to increase protectionism. Is this the guy that's driving things?
I think irrespective of what position, or if he does end up in some position within the Trump administration, I don't think there's any question Lighthizer will be the most influential voice in Trump's ears, either from within or from without the administration. And if people are not familiar with Robert Lighthizer, taking a look at that book would be well worth your while. Lighthizer has essentially concluded that all of the assumptions upon which the post-war rules-based global trade system were established basically no longer work for the United States. So that system that's been in place for going on 8 decades now, and which has been a primary driver of economic development and growth, from his point of view, that system has outlived its usefulness, and he would take a sledgehammer to it if he had an opportunity to. So I think people need to be aware of where Lighthizer is coming from on this.
Do you think there's any truth in what he says about that system being dead on its feet almost? Has it come into an end? We've got this very fragmented world at the moment.
Well, look, I don't think there is any question whatsoever that we've made some fundamental mistakes, and that a number of the assumptions we made at, you know, particularly when we entered this period of hyper-globalization, this period when the principles of free trade were ascendant, when I was starting my career in Washington as a trade negotiator in the 1980s, so many of the assumptions we made then, now with, you know, the benefit of 30 or 40 years of hindsight, we can see that we were simply wrong about that. Free trade doesn't always work out as nice and neatly as it does in economic textbooks, and that the market, you know, just getting out of the way, reducing barriers and letting the market operate in a world where not everybody's playing the game by the same set of rules does not always produce the results that you want. So clearly we're overdue for some significant modifications, a significant rethink on the trade system. But I don't know if it's smart to throw the baby out with the bathwater.
Right. So free trade only works if everybody's a good actor. And at the moment, not everybody is a good actor, more or less. Is that what we're saying?
Yes. And that Free trade, practically speaking, never has and never will exist. It's nice and neat in an economics textbook. The real world has never and will never be that way.
There's been this ongoing debate in American history. It chimes back to what you mentioned earlier and some of the points that Lighthizer makes. It's this strong isolationist philosophy that's always been there, battle against this idea that America should lead on international affairs and actually make the world great, just like America itself. It goes back centuries. Has anyone else in recent history really made these types of economic arguments in favor of tariffs like Lighthizer is doing now? I mean, we mentioned there's been this bipartisan shift towards protectionism, but is he an outlier? Because most economists are dismissive of these views because they see tariffs as a tax on U.S. consumers for the most part.
Well, you're right. Certainly the strong consensus within the economics profession is that tariffs ultimately are counterproductive. But look, the only issue in Washington, D.C. that Republicans and Democrats, liberals and conservatives agree on is that our approach to trade really hasn't worked, particularly with China, and that we need a fundamental reset. You know, I don't see those positions being reconciled. And I think particularly from the U.S. perspective, what we see today is also what we're going to see for the foreseeable future. For instance, you know, in my judgment, the U.S. is just out of the business of traditional free trade agreements. Traditionally, the United States was the leader in pushing forward trade and investment liberalization, both on a multilateral basis as well as in bilateral and regional agreements. I just don't see the U.S. going down that road. It's currently pursuing the IPEF, Indo-Pacific Economic Framework Agreement. But importantly, that agreement is more like a framework for cooperation, and it does not include the traditional market access provisions, which the traditional sort of meat and potatoes of free trade agreements. So I think U.S. trade partners should be aware that, at least in my judgment, at least for the foreseeable future, the U.S. is out of the business of free trade agreements.
I'll come back to that in a moment, if I can, Stephen. But just back to the specifics of who's driving what as we're coming up to the election, is there an equivalent to Lighthizer on the Democrat side if Harris wins in terms of ideas on trade and what's best for the U.S. economy?
It's actually an interesting point because, I mean, my goodness gracious, the Harris and the Trump camps agree on virtually nothing and are fighting like proverbial cats and dogs. But interestingly enough, Lighthizer has had some fairly supportive things to say about the Biden administration's trade representative, Catherine Tai. And if you ever got them out of a political environment and could have an off-the-record chat with them somewhere, I think you'd find a very, very, very significant degree of overlap between their positions. Keep in mind, Catherine Tai was on the House Ways and Means Committee during the renegotiation of NAFTA, which Lighthizer led. So they work together very closely on that, and they're simpatico on a lot of these trade issues. There is some talk that Tai might be tapped under a Harris administration to remain in the job. I don't know. I don't think anyone knows. But more importantly, if it's not Catherine Tai, it will be somebody like her. It will be someone from the same end of the philosophical spectrum. Tai deeply shares Kamala Harris's progressive leanings, particularly on issues like climate change, labor rights, human rights, etc. So if it's not Tai, it will be somebody who shares those four progressive values that Harris does. And I think you can expect to see those values reflected in U.S. trade policy under a Harris administration.
These bipartisan policy trends, they're not coming from anywhere. I mean, there is actually pressure from the electorate on both candidates to move manufacturing and jobs back to the US or just reduce reliance on China. How much of this reshoring or nearshoring is possible, especially if we're talking about companies moving out of China, which, let us not forget, is a huge market in its own right? Does the US or Mexico or anywhere else really offer what China offers?
Well, look, there certainly has been some movement on the margins. We talk about Vietnam as being a location that's received a number of production facilities from China seeking to move across the border in order to circumvent U.S. tariffs on China protection. But the point I always make to people when we think about supply chain relocation and onshoring or nearshoring is China is China for a reason. There is a reason why China has become the manufacturing powerhouse of planet Earth, and that is that China simply has overwhelming competitive advantages that other locations in the world simply cannot match. So China is not going to disappear from global supply chains under any scenario. As I mentioned, we think a lot about Vietnam as a potential alternative for Chinese production. But keep in mind, the single Chinese province of Guangdong has more industrial workers than the entire nation of Vietnam. And it's not just a question of the number of workers China has. They are in many respects highly skilled. So if you wanted to move a factory that makes plastic Christmas decorations to Vietnam, you could do so. That's low value-added manufacturing. But if you're talking about the higher value-added stuff, things like sophisticated medical equipment, those factories have to be certified. Those workers have to be highly trained. They're in China now, and they simply can't move anywhere else in the foreseeable future because of the ramp up in training and certifications that are required. So bottom line, China is China for a reason. We have seen a certain amount of relocations, but China is not, in at least in a meaningful way, going to be displaced from global supply chains anytime in the foreseeable future.
Is there any sense that, as politicians quite often claim, that the US can do these jobs, they can bring these jobs back home? Can they bring these factories home? I mean, you didn't mention that any big factory has a huge network of inbound and outbound suppliers, tier one, tier two, tier three. It's not just as simple as uprooting the factory and finding job people who can do those jobs, is it? But even if it was that simple, are the people available in the US with the right qualifications and the willingness to do these jobs?
Well, if we're talking about semiconductors, the clear answer is no. Because some of the large companies that have made commitments to the United States under the CHIPS Act have already announced that they're going to have to slow down or ramp down those plans because of difficulties in finding labor. So I think it's a real issue. And the other point I think needs to be made when Americans think about reshoring and bringing those factories back. Take a hypothetical situation. If you had a North Carolina furniture company, which left North Carolina in the year 2005 and headed to China, that factory might have employed 600 people. Well, if you could bring that factory back today, that's not 600 jobs in 2024. Thanks to automation, instead of 600 workers in that factory, you've got a dozen workers typing into laptops. So the idea that we're going to reshore these factories and there's going to be some kind of an employment boom belies the fact that, irrespective of trade issues, technology has moved forward to the point that these factories simply don't need the same number of human workers as they have in the past. So I think that's another thing we have to bear in mind.
And of course, we're still seeing exactly how generative AI will change that equation, probably not for the best in terms of job creation. Just to widen this out slightly for the international outlook, in terms of trade, how do you think the different candidates are viewed in, say, Europe or in Southeast Asia among decision makers who are interested in these trading relations? Is there a big difference between Europe and Southeast Asia? And what are the Chinese thinking about all this?
I think from China's perspective, it's a coin toss. And I think as one noted Chinese professor said at one point, it's choose your bowl of poison. I don't think there's a good option from China's perspective. More broadly, the one attitude that I encounter, certainly in East Asia and other places in the world that I visit frequently, I'm concerned that there's a certain degree of complacency. I run across an attitude that I would describe sort of like this. People are saying, well, we didn't like the first Trump administration, but we survived it. So if we survived Trump once, we could survive him again. In my judgment, that's a very serious and a very profound mistake. I think Trump 2.0 would be a magnitude of order worse than Trump 1.0. For a variety of reasons, during his first administration, for the first 2 years, Trump had the good sense to be a little bit scared. I don't think he expected to be president. I don't think he particularly wanted to be president. And he had more mainstream conventional thinkers in his administration that acted as guardrails. By the end of the administration, those guardrails were gone. The so-called adults in the room were no longer in the room. And I think the ending point for the first Trump administration would be the starting point for a second Trump administration. And I think, you know, in terms of management of global trade issues and geopolitical issues, I think that's going to complicate life quite a bit. So I would encourage people to reflect more deeply on how disruptive a Trump 2.0 could be as compared to a Trump 1.0. In terms of Harris, it's a bit of a tabula rasa. She hasn't expressed a lot of points of view on trade, but I think we've seen enough to indicate, you know, as I said earlier, this woman is not an ardent free trader. I don't think she's going to undo any of the trade restrictive practices put in place by either of her two predecessors. And I don't think she'll have any hesitancy when the interests of U.S. workers are involved to move to additional restrictions. So maybe that leaves us back with the Chinese professor and the choice between two bowls of poison.
This push towards trade barriers, this lack of enthusiasm for free trade, how is that playing out in terms of the U.S. relations with places in Asia, in the Middle East, and maybe in Africa in terms of leverage? Because if you can't offer free trade and you're in this existential competition with China, how does that play out in terms of your ability to project your own power?
Well, you put your finger on something extremely important. Traditionally, one of the ways in which the U.S. got what it wanted from foreign partners, foreign trade partners, was to use the carrot of preferential access to the U.S. market. Now the United States is involved in a lot of discussions, at least in the context of IPEF negotiations, on a formal agreement. However, the U.S. is not offering what these countries want most, which is preferential access to the U.S. market. So I don't think there's any question it will diminish the leverage that the U.S. enjoys in these discussions. How exactly that will play out in the context, for instance, of the IPEF agreement remains to be seen. But I don't think there's any question that the U.S. has less leverage.
Finally, Stephen, what advice would you give to shippers and supply chain professionals in terms of how they can prepare for or navigate either a Trump or a Harris administration in terms of the politics of trade?
Well, look, my strong advice would be to go into your boss's office and request a pay raise, because your job is going to get a lot harder for a variety of reasons. Certainly, all of the geopolitical tensions that we're talking about are complicating life, but there's other issues as well. Keep in mind, the number of our ordinarily traded products that now have become smart products and contain potential dual-use capabilities, civilian military capabilities, is expanding every month of the year. So I'm old enough to remember when a car was a method of transportation from point A to point B. Well, now, of course, a car is a supercomputer with four wheels attached. A refrigerator used to be a place you kept your milk and orange juice cold. Now that refrigerator knows everything that's going on inside your house and tells you when you need to buy more orange juice. So because an expanding portion of the products we trade contain dual-use technologies, the level of restrictions, the level of barriers, the additional permissions, licensing, certifications that you're going to have to get are only going to increase. Now, having said all that, I would say, despite that, the imperative to trade remains, the potential benefit for trade remains. So you've got to stay in the game, but I don't think there's any question your life is going to become more complicated and difficult.
Thanks, Stephen. I think you might have a better fridge than me, because it's my wife who tells me when we need more orange juice. But I take your point.
Well, let's not put her out of a job in that case. Yeah,
Sorry, just tickled me slightly there. Okay, thanks, Stephen. Hang with me, dear listeners, because coming up is Ed Bristois, VP of International Trade at the Consumer Technology Association. But for now, Stephen Olson, visiting fellow at the Institute of Southeast Asian Studies. Thanks for joining me today on the Freight Buyers Club.
My pleasure. Thanks very much.
This podcast is proudly produced in partnership with Demerco Express Group, a trusted provider of global shipping and contract logistics services in Asia, Europe, and North America. Demerco's particular strength is in Asia, where it gives shippers the freight capacity and local market expertise to streamline freight movements to and from the region, particularly for trans-Pacific lanes. With 130 forwarding and logistics locations across China, India, and Southeast Asia, Demerco connects Asia with the world like no other global 3PL. You are listening to the Freight Buyers Club.
Okay, as promised, next up we have Ed Bristoir, VP for International Trade at the Consumer Technology Association, who I spoke to at a recent supply chain conference organized by The Economist Impact in Dubai. Apologies for any background noise, but we recorded in the conference venue. Ed leads CTA's International Trade and Supply Chain Advocacy Team at the US federal level. So basically, he speaks up for members, for his members to Congress and anywhere else where their trade interests are not being best served or could be served better. We discussed the type of international trade policies that his US members want and also what they don't want from the next US administration. I started by asking Ed how his members have been coping with US tariff regime, starting with the first Trump presidency.
The US-China trade war that started in 2018 deeply impacted consumer technology companies in the United States. It's a conventional wisdom to think that there's only a handful of tech companies. That is totally not true. Within CTA's membership, we have 1,300 companies, 80% of which are small businesses. And these are a lot of companies that are making and designing consumer tech products for not just the US market, but for the global market as well. So over the course of the last 40 years, many of these companies decided that they wanted to manufacture something. They went to China because that was the best manufacturing ecosystem. High quality, low cost, contract manufacturers existed there to build things at large scale. So when the Section 301 investigation happened, CTA was very engaged on that. But then when the tariffs hit, that impacted our membership significantly. And we've been one of the most vocal associations arguing that the tariffs should never have been imposed. They're going to be ineffective, and they have been ineffective. And we continue to say this both to the Trump administration and now the Biden administration. Just going through like the different lists, you know, there was list one, then there was list two, which is $16 billion in trade. Then there was list three, which is even more, list 4A. So all of those lists impacted not just the inputs for consumer tech manufacturing, but also the finished goods that many of our members were making in China, then trying to import to the US. But that was just the starting point of their troubles. Once the pandemic happened and you had that historically high demand, which increased the cost of shipping, they were no longer able to absorb any of the tariff costs because they had to pay so much in shipping. So those costs all got passed on ultimately to US consumers.
So it ended up being a tax on US consumers. Back to your membership just briefly. So 80% are, we could call them SMEs. So we're not talking Silicon Valley type behemoths. You're also representing these small guys. I'm from the UK, where obviously we've had Brexit, and the companies that suffered most were the smaller ones who didn't have the economies of scale to handle increased transaction costs. Have these road bumps, these tariffs, have they hit some of your members disproportionately negatively? Particularly those smaller companies. Is that a fair assumption to make?
I would say it's more personal for them because these are small business founders. You know, they stake their livelihoods on the success of their businesses. And the things they've had to do to keep in business have been quite challenging. And I would say many of those companies, maybe they weren't able to survive. The ones that have, they were exceptionally gifted at being able to adapt to changing circumstances, to pivoting. So our big member companies, they're affected as well because many of the products that they want to make in the United States still require inputs, raw materials, components, or subcomponents that are made in China. And it's very difficult for those supply chains to move out of China. So when the tariffs go into effect, some of these companies are importing at such high volumes that their tariff costs are just astronomical. So if you look at who paid the tariffs by sector, the consumer technology sector has paid, I would say, over a quarter of the tariffs, almost one third. And through the entire lifespan of the tariffs from 2018 through today.
Okay, so taking into account we've had these tariffs going back to 2018, introduced under the first Trump administration, not many of them, or any at all, in fact, have really been rescinded by the Biden administration. We're hearing different things from different people in the Harris camp and in the Trump camp in terms of what they're going to do around tariffs. Certainly from the Republican side, some of those numbers are quite extreme. We're talking 100% tariffs, much higher in some cases, maybe on EVs, a universal tariff on all imports of 10%. So with all that in mind, what are you after from the next administration, Ed?
So we want them to understand that tariffs are taxes on Americans, and they're regressive. They harm poor people, people of little means. And if you're imposing tariffs on consumer technology products, you're making it more difficult for those consumers to buy the products. And you're creating, in my view, a much bigger digital divide. People with more means are still going to be able to buy them, even if they pay more. For the next administration, we've got two different viewpoints. One, the Trump administration has proposed all those tariffs that you're talking about, the 10 to 20% universal baseline tariff, a 60% flat tariff on all imports from China. We just did put out a new report on the impact of those proposed tariffs on the consumer technology industry just last week, actually. And the conclusion is that consumers would take a massive hit. So the purchasing power of U.S. consumers for consumer technology products would decrease by $90 billion. So just in terms of the price increases, laptops and tablets would see a 46% price increase. Video game consoles, 40% price increase. Smartphones, 26%. Those price increases would lead to less purchases of those products by Americans. So Americans, they may say they're willing to pay more for a product made in the United States, but if the price is too high, they're not going to be able to purchase those products. It's not in their budget. You know, they don't want to pay it out of their pocketbooks.
There's not many economists that would, on a general level, support these higher tariffs. Most would say tariffs are a tax on U.S. consumers, not a means to earn income. But their proponents argue that the end point here is bringing jobs back to the U.S. or protecting those that are already there. No doubt they would ask, why aren't your members, CTA members, these technology companies, why aren't they bringing some of these jobs back to the U.S.? What's the difficulties they face, Ed, if they want to be competitive and but also want to bring jobs back? Is there a reason why they can't make U.S. products in the U.S. for U.S. consumers?
So we took a really hard look at this. We issued a study in October of last year that was done for us by the consultancy Kearney. And we looked at the business case for moving all the production of consumer technology products for the U.S. market back to the United States. And what we found was that would be a $500 billion direct business investment over the course of 10 years to do that, and a 10x increase in the amount of labor. The labor just isn't there to do this in the first place. And that's even before you get to other types of externalities and costs, like environmental costs to, you know, stand up all that new production. Energy costs, very significant. So we didn't think that was desirable or feasible, mainly because the more you tried to force that manufacturing into your country, you're doing it at the expense of your allies and your key trading partners, who are very likely going to retaliate. And that's exactly what's going to happen if the former president comes into office and imposes that 10% or 20% universal baseline tariff or the 60% tariff or all the other tariffs he's talking about. Countries are going to retaliate. That harms U.S. exporters. That makes us less competitive. That decreases the viability of the United States as a place where people want to produce.
Have we seen some diversification to avoid tariffs, perhaps, or to build up resilience, or even to boost that profit line?
The Section 301 tariffs did not lead to significant increases in employment in the consumer tech industry in the United States or the manufacturing of those products. By and large, the production of those products shifted to third countries like Vietnam and Mexico, other Southeast Asian countries. Vietnam and Mexico are two of the biggest beneficiaries of the trade war with China. India to a lesser extent, but that's what's going to happen as well with the new proposed Trump tariffs, is that the production is not, even with like the 10% or 20% production moves out of China, it'll go to these other countries. It's not going to come to the United States. And so it's just a tax on American consumers at that point, and that tax is going to be passed on.
Are you worried on a more general level in the US, but not just in the US, we're seeing the rise of populism, the rise of protectionism, Do you feel that the type of globalization is a commitment to free trade that has prospered post-Second World War, and especially the last 20 to 30 years? Has that landscape now disappeared, or is it disappearing? And as we look in the future, are we banking on a zero-sum game where trade's all about winning and losing?
No, I think that there's always going to be a desire by people to trade and to interface with other parts of the world. If the political world wants to cut the United States off from other markets, you know, whether they're friendly countries or adversaries, I suspect that people and business in the United States are not going to put up with that. Our track record on bans and prohibition isn't quite good. People try to get around it.
They certainly did. Ed Briswell, thanks for joining me today on the Freight Buyers Club.
My pleasure. Thanks so much.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Freight Buyers Club, produced in partnership with the DeMerco Express Group. Please subscribe and follow on your platform of choice, or sign up for delivery to your inbox at thefreightbuyersclub.com. This podcast wouldn't have been possible without the fantastic editing of Karen Ball and Tom Matthews. And finally, thank you all for listening. The next episode will be with you soon.